welcome to another episode of Celluloid Citizens. As always, I'm Sean M. Thompson.
And I'm Gemma Files.
And on the episode today, we're going to be discussing the 2020 film, The Night House. And I believe it was written and directed by David Bruckner. Oh, I lied. Directed by David Bruckner, written by Ben Collins and Luke Piotrowski, starring Rebecca Hall, Sarah Goldberg, Vondi, Curtis Hall, and Evan, oh boy, Evan Jonicate. I think it's Scandinavian.
Ah.
But yeah, so I had watched this first and I recommended it because it had been on my radar, but it had been theatrical only. And that can be sort of tricky.
So. Yes, yeah.
But now that it's not one of those $20 rentals, I think it's more readily available.
Yeah, it actually went straight from you being able to buy it, quote, forever on Crave up here in Toronto to just normal rental fee. So that was fun. So I was able to see it on VOD.
Nice.
Yeah.
Still throwing me for a loop that the older black guy's last name is Hall, but I don't think they're related.
No, I don't believe they are either.
No, I know. But yes, yeah. Rebecca Hall is great in this. She had been in things, but I guess I wasn't. I mean, I must have been aware of her at the time, but the name didn't really stick.
Rebecca Hall's a fascinating kind of presence because when she pops up in things doing sort of subordinate roles or supporting roles, she's extremely good at what she does. So she just kind of disappears into those roles. But whenever she gets to occupy the protagonist slot, that's when she really starts to land, from my point of view. And yeah, I think the first time that I registered her as an actress was in a protagonist role. Stephen Volk, wrote a ghost movie, called one moment. The Awakening.
Oh, okay. I've seen the cover of that, but I never watched it.
Yeah. It's very old school. She plays a woman in the early 1920s who is a debunker.
Okay.
Sort of semi-professionally. There was a huge spike in spiritualism immediately after the First World War.
Yeah, I've noticed the 20s tends to be when I hear about spiritualism.
Yeah, and, you know, so she goes around breaking up seances and, proving that what appears to be ghosts are not actually ghosts. They're people dressed up or, you know, some kind of scientific fakery, et cetera. And then she gets called in to look at, again, what appears to be a ghost at a boys' school in the country. And things begin to go spookily. It's not a perfect film, but she is amazing at it. She is, yeah. And that was the moment when I was like, wow, Rebecca Hall, she's great.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about Night House, and we'll get into it, I guess, but in terms of it, I really liked it, but there are definitely, I could see somebody without the same kind of screen presence, maybe the film wouldn't be as good, but Rebecca Hall really sells the kind of smarmy grieving widow.
Smarmy. Angry.
Angry, I would say,
more than smarmy. Snarky, I think, might be closer to it, but yeah. She has an incredible energy to her performances when she's allowed to access it. And she's also like an interesting physical presence because she's so tall, and she takes up so much space, literally and figuratively. And so when somebody allows her to just like access all the parts of her personality, I think it's one of the best things ever.
Yeah. Yeah. And, I had watched, let's see, in terms of David Bruckner, I had watched, I think Southbound is what it's called.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then the one I really knew him from though was the adaptation of the Adam Neville novel, The Ritual.
That's right. Which is brilliant.
Yeah, it's really good. So when I heard that guy did another movie, it was like, oh, all right, check it out. And I had heard good things, and yeah, I was pleasantly surprised.
Yeah. Yeah, The Ritual rapidly became one of my favorite things to put on Netflix and just let it spin, because there's no part of it that's bad. What I do find interesting about his stuff, and remind me, did he actually direct No One Gets Out Alive?
I don't think so. Let
no,
me double
you're right,
check.
You're right. He was the producer.
Oh, he produced it. Okay.
I'm pretty sure. Yes.
And yeah, he was an executive producer.
Yeah, he was an executive producer, and I think he's part of that company, The Imaginarium, who also did The Ritual.
Yeah, I'm not.
And seemed to be working directly with Adam Neville. I think they were the same people that he developed Cunning Folk for originally, because Cunning Folk was supposed to be a straight up script, like a movie script, a screenplay.
Yeah.
And then he redid it as a book after that.
Oh, all right.
You know, I don't know if it fell through or what. Sometimes it's easier that way. It's interesting. I think Guillermo del Toro did the same thing with The Strain.
I mean,
he and his writing partner ended up being like, well, why don't we write it as a series of books and then sell it?
Even if you're going to eventually get it like made, and that's almost a sure thing.
Yeah.
It's such a long process. I can see why people decide, well, if we can do this, why don't we also release it as a book?
And yeah, absolutely.
Then if it falls through, we still have something.
Yeah. I have to say that the times that I've written scripts, I've found it very difficult to turn them from a script into something that's not a script, because if you're doing it the right way, there's not a lot of stuff left over. But
yeah, I haven't. I guess the closest I've come is there's been a kind of novel in progress that I've had a couple failed attempts on that I tried, or I guess I'm still currently trying to write as a show. That I thought maybe when I'm done writing as a show, I'll go back and make it a novel, but I don't actually know if I'm going to do it. So
yeah, IMHO, I think that novels adapt better to shows overall, that it needs a bit of an episodic.
Yeah. I was going to say the thing about a film is it tends to work better as a, an adaptation tends to work better from like a short story or like a, you know, short novel, novelette, novella.
Yeah, exactly.
Just because of the, you know, it's condensed, it's smaller.
Yeah.
So then, you're just expanding on the script rather than having to, you know, there's nothing worse when it seems like you're trying to fit all sorts of stuff into like a hour and a half block.
Yeah, that's incredibly difficult. So the better way to go with a book if you're trying to shove it into that block is to take out a bunch of it. The same way that they did with The Ritual, where they took out all the black metal stuff.
Yeah. I was going to say recently I was thinking of Midnight Mass. It seemed very much like a novel.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the rumor I heard was that he was trying to write that as a novel, and he either did and didn't send it anywhere, or it fell through.
Yeah.
And then he was trying to get it made at Netflix, and they didn't initially make it, but then he got to make some other stuff, and then eventually they let him do this.
It it smacked a lot to me of the same kind of development path as, say, Storm of the Century.
Yeah, I was going to say it was very King-like. Like, it seemed like, you know, like a Lost King novel, like to the point where I definitely saw people like, is this a King adaptation?
Nope. Yeah, I mean, it's sort of like he took Storm of the Century and shoved Salem's Lot up it, so to speak.
Yeah, basically, yeah. But yeah, we're talking about Nighthouse, though. So
yeah, we are talking about the Nighthouse.
I guess right off the bat, what I love about this film is that it gets to the point very quickly. Like the first 5 minutes, it's Rebecca Hall's character, and I'm going to have to actually I always blank on her name.
Yeah.
Beth, yes.
Beth coming it's home from work.
Beth coming home, and she's outside quickly. Her house, and I believe it's her, I assumed it was her mother.
No, it's her friend.
Oh, is it her friend?
I'm pretty sure it's the same friend, yeah.
Okay.
She doesn't have many friends, as far as I can tell. It's like...
No, she doesn't. She seems to have, like, one. But, so she gets a casserole, and you kind of hear through the door them giving their condolences. And she goes inside and just immediately throws it out.
Yeah. And starts this one song by Richard Thompson over and over. Which is...
Yeah, man, he must have been thrilled with this movie, because, like, talk about a signal boost.
Oh, yeah.
And I didn't realize this until the second watch, but what I like is they actually cut back to her at one point, and she's eating the casserole, and I hadn't realized that she had just dug it out of the trash.
Exactly. So she must have gotten it out of the trash and put it in the microwave.
Right, because at first I was like, oh, you know, she's got some food, but then I was like, wait, that's the casserole dish, so...
Yep. You know, she is, and she's drinking, and she's, like, you know, dancing, just kind of swaying back and forth to this music.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very, like, intimate way to start your film.
Yeah, but it's a real plunge into what the film is about, and what the film is about, you know, and she's watching home movies.
Yeah.
Home movies of her wedding, home movies of... when her husband, who was obviously a, what do you call that?
Begins with an A.
Architect, very good. Her husband, who obviously was an architect, was working on the house that they lived in together, which he spearheaded the building of and built half of himself. So It's a very intimate introduction to the basic theme of the movie, which is grief. And
yeah.
I was going to say, when we got a little off track and talking about adaptations and stuff like that, that the weird thing about the path that Bruckner has kind of carved out for himself is that most of the stuff that he's done so far has been about grief. It's been about the aftermath of trauma.
Yeah.
As in The Ritual, where it was reframed as what was supposed to be a lad's holiday amongst these five friends ends up being a sort of pilgrimage that they undertake after one of the friends is killed during a robbery.
Yeah, I haven't actually read the novel. Is that did they just sort of invent that for the film?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
It's just a lad's weekend.
Okay. I'd heard they cut the black metal stuff from the novel, but
yeah.
And, well, that's interesting. That I mean, because I thought it worked really well for The Ritual.
Yeah, and then to move from that directly to this, which seems to be to some degree the inverse, because, you know, like I said, she only has like one friend. She's alone a lot of the time. She's, you know, it's she's front and center. And we're kind of like not only just inside of her life and inside of her house, but inside of her, just her dealing directly with the aftermath of her particular trauma. And her particular trauma is that her husband, we very, very quickly find out, is not just dead, he also killed himself, which
Yeah,
is.
he shot himself on a boat on the I think it's a lake
Yeah,
outside their
that's right. The
house.
lake outside their house. Their house is about halfway up a cliff. There's a very steep set of stairs going down directly to a dock with a boat attached to it. And, a very beautiful, secluded place, which, absolutely designed to be peaceful and in the midst of nature, like a, like a love nest for the two of them. You really get the feeling that they lived in a world of their own, literally and figuratively. Very fun.
Yeah, which is why it seems so tragic that the husband killed himself, because you realize now that it's just her, like she's sort of done that thing a lot of couples end up doing when they move somewhere isolated, where it's like, so she has basically one friend from what I can see,
Yeah,
and she has a
and
teaching position, but she doesn't, I mean, we see her hanging out with some of the staff later, but she doesn't necessarily seem like she gets along with them.
no, she's absolutely a very solitary person, and the impression that we get over the first 15 to 20 minutes of the film is that she was always a very lonely, isolated, solitary, singular human being. And then she met this guy, and the two of them bonded hard and fast. And it was as though nobody else existed in the world for them. And to have that taken away from you is horrible. And it would be, but it, you know, I was going to say it would be equally horrible if he had just died in a car crash, or if he had, or if he had, suddenly had a heart attack, or, died of an aneurysm or something like that. But no, actually, she also has to deal with the anger that comes along with being the person who's left behind when somebody kills themselves. And it's a terrible kind of anger because it feels like the aftermath of violence, but you also feel selfish.
I can imagine, it's a hard, 'cause it's like naturally you'd be angry at your partner, but at the same time it's like they literally killed themselves, so clearly they're not, they must have been in a lot of pain.
What was wrong with me that I couldn't see that they were in that amount of pain?
I mean, you hear about that a lot though, like there are
Yes.
people that, their partner takes their own life and they're like, I and everyone just assumes, oh, you must have seen something, and they're like, nope.
Nope. No,
Because
actually,
sadly, usually
yeah.
the people that end up doing it and like follow through are the people that don't talk about it.
Yes. When she finally speaks about it, she says, he killed himself out of the blue using a gun that I didn't even know he had.
Right. So there's a lot of
Resentment.
mystery, yeah, about the actual,
Yeah.
act itself.
Yeah. Mystery and resentment. And it's like that usual thing of, were you keeping secrets? What kind of secrets were you keeping from me? And as it turns out, he was keeping a lot of secrets from her.
Pretty big fucking
Yeah,
secrets,
pretty big
yeah.
fucking secrets. But, I mean, this is the problem with intimacy, right? I've been married for, a very long time at this point,
Okay, yeah.
over 25 years. And, my son just turned 17. And, intimacy is, it can only ever be up to a certain point because you are two separate people and you have to some degree, allow each other your interior space. There's stuff that I think about that I don't tell my husband about, and I can only assume it's the same way with him. And, but there is this feeling of détente, right? There is this
Yeah.
feeling that we have a, we have a methodology for dealing with each other, and we, take the load for each other. We take up the slack, blah, blah, blah. I don't know how long they've been married. It doesn't seem like a real long time, because
No, it
they
only
don't look
seemed like
very
a,
different
yeah.
in the wedding, in the wedding footage, but I'd say maybe 3 years, maybe 5 years at the most. I mean, you know, you have to factor in however long it took him to build the house. But yeah, it seems like they were expecting to live the rest of their lives with each other, you know, to die very close to each other.
Yeah.
And all of that is gone. All of that has been, you know, the train went off the tracks.
Yeah, and I think one of the earlier scenes, so she's trying to get just like her life back in order. So she goes back to the school she works at for some sort of staff meeting.
Yeah, that's right.
And her friend Claire, played by Sarah Goldberg, says, "You didn't have to come."
Nobody expected you to. Nobody would expect you to be here.
Right.
And she's like, no, I need to. And besides, I need to input my marks. I did a bunch of marks, and then I didn't actually put them in the system. And you know, as a former teacher, I was like, I hear you. That thing where you're sitting in your classroom and nobody's there and you're inputting marks is fairly familiar for me. And a woman comes in, and she is the mother of one of her students. And so I guess she teaches speech and language.
Yeah.
The mother is doing that thing that the parents do where they kind of try to they kind of try to trip you up. You know, it's like, well, you said that he could make up this speech presentation and then he came in to do it on the last day of school, but you weren't there. And she's like, oh yeah, yes, that's true. That's right, I had a personal issue. And the woman's like, well, you know, personal issues are one thing, but and she sort of looks at her and she goes, yeah, the personal issue was that my husband shot himself.
Right. It's sort of like in a sick way. I mean, I could imagine that'd be like a
Slap
fantasy
hands, you know,
teachers
it's
would
like,
have of like, all right, you want to know?
yeah, you want to know my personal issue? You know, and she's like, oh, I didn't know. I couldn't have. And she's like, no, because it was a personal issue.
And I love, she's like, what do you want to be? Boom, B. And she's like, oh, you want an A? And she just like clearly does not fucking care. Like,
Boom. And yeah, crack a boom, you naff wanker. Here's your A. And the mom looks at her and goes, a B is fine. Which was beautiful. But yes, you're absolutely right. She's angry. She is snarky. She is not making it easy on anybody. And she's not there to make it easy on anybody. And that's one of the things that I find most interesting about this performance. You know, she feels like she's being wronged and she's right to feel that way. You know, it's like she felt that she felt that everything was in balance and that, you know, that she was doing her part and she felt that she thought she knew the way that things were supposed to go. And then suddenly, spring, you know, her
yeah, and I
whole.
think one of the other tragic elements is, and we'll get into it like later on because she brings this up a few times, but
Yeah.
she's actually the one that is like the depressive,
Person, yeah.
that if people were to look at both of them, they would think, oh, she would be the one who might have suicidal ideation. And he's like, seemed like the rock, like the, kind of supportive
Yep.
husband. So the fact that
Happy.
he's the one that did it.
Yeah, just a happy, light, sunny person, you know, strong in mind and body, right? You know, it's
Yeah.
biceps. Look at the biceps. You know. Yeah, absolutely. She expected him to be the supportive person, and there was something going on that she did not know about. And again, when you're depressive, whenever something goes wrong, you're going to think it's your fault.
Right. That's just a natural thing.
Yeah. But particularly, you know, it's like, oh, God, the darkness seeped out of me and it seeped into him. And
yeah, it really does approach that fear that I think a lot of, I mean, I'm a depressive, but yeah, that a lot of depressives have, where it's like, is my shit going to like ruin people?
Yes, exactly.
And this is sort of like the worst nightmare scenario of that.
Oh, yeah. You know, I mean, it reminds me of, you know, the part right at the beginning of The Empty Man, where, you know, you're in the middle of nowhere supporting your depressive friend who self-harms all the time and,
yeah,
you know, is always at the end of his rope. And, you know, and you just can't, you know, you can't do that one more time. And it's like, it's always something with this guy. Well, yeah, you know, it's not the same thing in this particular case.
Right, yeah.
It's always something with this guy. And I'm sure she spent a lot of time going, you know, yeah, I'm the person that it's always something with.
Yeah, so, I mean, chronologically, you know, we're introduced to her in the house.
Mm-hmm.
She goes to the meeting. And a lot of this film, though, is just, it's in the house.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, hence the night house.
Well, it's not the night house per se.
Well, that's the house house, but there is a night house we discover.
Exactly, and we're going to get to that pretty soon. The other thing that I think we should rope in here, however, when she goes to the staff meeting, one of the other people who's obviously a friend of her friend, comes over and says, "Well, we're going out afterwards. Why don't you come out? Why don't you, you know," it's like, and her friend is like, yeah, come on, you know, let's go have a drink. You deserve it. Let's do it, you know.
Right. Which is like, I don't have any friends that have partners that have killed themselves, but that seems like a phenomenally bad idea.
No, absolutely. You know, but.
What are you, depressed and angry about your dead husband? Let's go drink about it.
Exactly. Because, you know, it's like, it's not like drinking makes you more depressed or more angry. Or yeah, relaxing.
And this is a fairly masterful scene because, like, they're at some just bar.
Yeah.
And all the other teachers are just having their usual, I can't believe this student, they were such a pain in the ass type of things.
Yes. Yeah. And what about so and so? Da 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 da. You know.
And then finally, Beth interrupts or interjects and is like, do any of you believe in ghosts? Because we haven't really mentioned it, but there have been sort of like strange things that have occurred, like the stereo turned on in the middle of the night, I think.
That's right. Yeah, the stereo turning on in the middle of the night, feeling watched, feeling observed, things at the edge of your consciousness, you know. And she has dreams a lot. She has,
yeah,
you know, she often has dreams which seem like something that actually happens. And I think even by that point, we've seen the thing of wet footsteps,
yeah,
coming up the dock, as though, I don't know, a guy who fell into the lake, you know, after shooting himself in the head has, you know, walked up out of the water. Yes. And yeah, so she throws that out there. And then she mentions that. Another thing which really is like front and center in terms of the themes of this film, which is, you know, because we had a pact together that if one of us died first, then they would come back and try to convince the other that there was something after death. And to be frank, it was him. He was the person who said, I'm going to come back. And,
right, yeah, because her whole thing is that she doesn't believe in anything. Like,
yeah, she doesn't believe in anything after death, and she has reason not to believe in anything after death because when she was a kid, I think around 15, 16.
Yeah, like a teenager.
She was in a car accident, and she died and was resuscitated. And
I think she said she was dead for 4 minutes.
Yeah,
I mean, I don't know the science, but I'm like, is that? I guess that's possible. I don't know.
I think you can be dead for 6 minutes and be resuscitated. Okay. I might be wrong. I think I'm remembering that from Reanimator. So, you know. Yeah, so it might be wrong. It might be, you know, whatever.
In any case, it's a very long time to be dead and resuscitated.
It's a very long time to be dead. And from her point of view, she doesn't remember anything. From her point of view, it was nothing. Literally
right.
nothing.
Right, there's this great line where she says everybody wants there to be a light at the end of the tunnel, but it's just tunnel.
Yeah, it's just tunnel. And tunnel in darkness. And you end up kind of lying to people about it, because it's easier than, you know, letting everybody down. But, you know, in a lot of ways, I think I wonder whether she was a depressive person before that happened, because to be frank, you know, that would be the kind of thing that would make you
a bit depressed. Yeah.
A bit depressed about, you know, there's this line that I've said in a lot of different interviews recently, which is the fact is that life revolves around the rim of a big black hole. And none of us know what's in the hole, but we all know we're going in there eventually.
Right.
And yeah, that, you know, that existential dread, doubt, that understanding that the center of your world, literally the center of your world, is nothing.
Almost. I think I was three and I almost choked to death on a hard candy in a parking lot. It was a long time. Apparently it was enough that my face turned like blue. And I think eventually what happened was some drunk guys in the bar that may or may not have been firefighters lifted me upside down and punched me in the back. I would have been, I think I said three.
Wow.
And thankfully it was young enough. I don't really remember it, but I'm sure that's somewhere in my brain all the time.
Yeah. I remember I had a full blown, existential meltdown when I was about 8 or 9. And I realized that I was going to die and that nobody could do anything about it.
You know? Yeah. I mean, that's the human condition, basically.
Yes. That is the human condition. You know, we're
I was on a film set the other day and this guy was like, he was like trying to do that pep talk of like, you should live your dreams. He's like, cause you're going to die. And I was like, dude, I know. Like, trust me, I am aware.
Believe me.
I'm a horror writer. That's like my main thing.
Yeah, exactly. But there, you know, there are so many people who drift through life. I mean, and not even drift through life, you know, but they're trying to keep things light and bright.
Yeah.
And I understand that. I completely understand that. But I think it does mean that when something does happen that causes you to see beyond the light and bright, that it hits you three times as hard. And again, I think that's also part of the anger that she feels, which is, you know, it's like I've been circling this big black hole since I was 15, and yet I still feel like I got punched in the stomach. I still feel like, you know, it's like, oh, I did have something to lose. Yeah, fuck.
Yeah.
And
so
now it's gone.
The people she's drinking with, I don't know if you felt like this, but I've seen this now twice. And I was like, why would you say this to a woman whose husband just killed himself? But like, you know, they do like, were there any signs? And sort of like that probing kind of questions that are like sort of low key blaming you.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, again, I don't think it helps that they're out drinking.
No, it doesn't. Because it, you know, it lowers people's inhibitions. So it's stuff they probably would have kept bottled up otherwise, but they're drunk. So they just say it.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, it's like the worst situation. And I agree. You would think that no one would ever put themselves in that situation, but people do it. People do it all the time. And, you know, and again, this is like really good writing and it's really good acting. And
yeah, because it's sort of that believable, like, you're there with your friends, so you're trying not to, like, if you were there alone, you'd be like, fuck you and leave, but
yes,
you're there with your friend who is also friends with these people, so you're like, all right, I need to just try to be, like, cool about it, even though she has every right to just flip out on everybody.
Yeah, and the relationship with her friend is really interesting. When you think about it, because she absolutely is like a bridge between Beth and everybody else.
Yeah.
In the world.
Yeah, but so at some point, the suicide note is introduced. This is, I think, a half an hour in.
Yes.
And it's fascinating because they're like, well, did he leave a note? And she's like, yes. And then they realize she carries the suicide note in her purse everywhere she goes.
Sure.
So she just takes it out. And I'm going to paraphrase because I don't remember the exact line, but it's something to the effect of, like, right. You were right. There is nothing. You are safe now.
Yeah. There is no, you were right. There is nothing. Nothing is after you. You're right. Safe now.
You are safe now. Yeah. And so, like, on top of the shit cake, that's like the icing. Because it's like, not only did her husband, who gave no signs, off himself, then that was the note he left. And you can really sense her anger in the scene. Because she's like, no, love you, honey. He's like, no, kisses, just, there's nothing. You were right. You're safe. Bye.
Not even bye.
Not even bye. Yeah, he doesn't even say goodbye.
You're safe now. Yeah, and yes, so here we are. We're half an hour in, and we're like, Beth, your life purely sucks. You are perfectly correct.
I mean, and it's funny how the house itself, too, which is so beautiful, and like it's on a lake, and it's quiet, and it's peaceful, but it's like the second, you know, her husband's gone, it's just this albatross, like, across her neck. It's just like this.
I mean, you know, her friend says, why don't you sell it? You know, and she says,
and we do actually at one point, she is, you know, looking at listings.
Yeah.
I will say one thing. She's in upstate New York and she's looking at houses for, like, I think one of them was 280. And I'm like, that's not,
that's not a thing.
I'm like, you would get a fucking closet in upstate New York for 280, but.
Okay. All right. I will take your.
I mean, maybe, you know, that's not maybe necessarily true because it is very isolated. So there are probably parts you could get a decent house for cheap, but
yeah,
I think even 280 is probably on the lower end.
Yeah. And, you know, yeah, so she's to some degree stuck in this house and.
Right. Yeah. Cause she's like, she's clearly trying to price it out.
Yeah. And all the things about the house that she probably loved when her husband was there are things which you would not want to be in a house in the middle of the woods next to a lake with gigantic windows, which let all the night in.
You know? Yeah. It reminds me of like when I, well, it's like when you go somewhere very scenic and isolated, like somewhere in nature, and during the day, you're like, this is amazing, incredible. And the second it gets dark, you're like, this is fucking awful. Why am I here?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And hopefully you didn't go there alone.
Right. Yeah. And then usually the small favor is, well, I'm here with someone else in case something happens. But yeah, if you happen to be alone, that's even worse.
Exactly. So, she is, yeah, she's, it's sort of like she's living in a dead version of her life.
Yeah.
And, constantly reminded, of the live version of her life.
I mean, her husband also built the house, so there's not even that disconnect of,
yeah, exactly.
It's just a house. Like, he literally, it's his house.
Yeah. So, you know, first she comes home and she starts to just pack it up. She starts to pack up all his stuff. She starts to get rid of everything. And I remember when I was watching it, I was literally, you know, talking to the screen and going, oh, don't do that. Because, yeah, that's your first impulse. But eventually you're going to want to look through all his stuff. And,
right, yeah.
And try and
I think immediately after they're done drinking,
yeah,
Claire actually comes home with her.
Yes.
To sort of comfort her, and they get into more. This is when Beth says, I was the depressive. She explains when she died.
Yeah.
And eventually she's just sort of laying on Claire's leg.
On her lap. Yeah.
On her lap, yeah. And like, I'm not ashamed to admit this jump scare got me. I mean, it's very loud, but
yeah,
you know, I'd like to think I'm immune, but I am not.
Yeah.
Because it's like, I think it's the setup where it's like, you know, she's laying in Claire's lap. So you figure, well, if something's going to happen, Claire's at least there. But she does say, well, I'll wait until you fall asleep and then I'll leave.
Yes.
And then it's like, boom, she's just like, it's just like
Alone.
staticky. That song is blaring.
Wah, wah, wah. Yeah, absolutely.
And she's just sort of like completely dazed, running around and like.
It
I know
doesn't help
some,
that she
she
probably
sees
has a
something.
massive hangover, you
Yeah,
know.
she's probably super hungover too, but.
But yes, she sees a shadow. She sees something. And again, it's like a reflection in nothing. You know, the kind of thing that you expect to see in a window, but
Yeah.
it's not in a window, it's in the air. Let's jump into it. Okay, so at a certain point, she discovers two things. The
Yeah.
first one is that she starts looking around on her husband's computer,
Yeah.
and is it the computer or the phone? No,
Well, I
the
think it
phone.
starts with her looking through his phone.
Yes.
And she finds this picture that at first she almost thinks is her, but she kind of zooms in and realizes it's just a random woman in a bookstore. So she shows that to Claire, who's trying to be supportive, but also trying to be like, you know, you should respect his privacy. I mean, he's dead. He can't defend himself.
Yeah, I
But
mean,
eventually she starts wondering about it. So she goes on his computer, and that's where she finds an entire folder of pictures of women that look vaguely like her.
that's right. Yeah, the big thing was, okay, who does that look like? Well, it's you. No, it's not me. I don't even know where that is.
Right.
You know, and her friend says this rather wonderful line. Well, let's just say it's you or something like that, you know.
I mean, she says something like, there are worse things to find on your husband's phone than a fully closed picture of a woman that looks like you.
Yes, exactly. And at the same time, she also starts to have dreams which involve going down to the dock,
Yeah.
getting in the boat and looking across the lake and seeing a light on the other shore.
Yeah, like basically from what is maybe a house.
Yes, exactly. From what is maybe a house, but it would have to be a house located in exactly the same spot, almost reflectively,
Yeah.
as her house. Now, I do not remember whether or not there's the intervening thing of her going through his stuff, that she's already put in boxes, finding a couple of very odd books, which, yeah, one of which is a diary that she gave him. And it was supposed to be a sketchbook for his architectural drawings.
Yeah.
And she is going through it and comes across some very strange scribbling, like trick it, don't listen to it. And then she finds a sketch which appears to be the floor plan of their house, but it's reversed.
Yeah. So
And
that's not great.
yeah, so that's not great. And then she's going through some of his other books, discovers something, the name of which I cannot remember, but it's a book of mazes, basically.
Yeah.
It's a book of
I think it was a word with a C, but I can't. It was like K.
Philematria or something along those lines.
Yeah.
And in the back, she notices a stamp from a particular bookstore that she's never been to in town. Goes
Yeah.
to that bookstore and is like, you know, I need to talk to somebody about this book that my husband bought. Do you have records? You know, if I give you his name, could you tell me what else he bought here? You know, and the guy's like, oh, I don't know. And what's her name? Dominique?
Let me see here.
Dominique Evangeline, something with a weird kind of.
Yeah, let me see. Sorry, it just closed out on me. Madeline?
Madeline, with a Y.
Yeah, with a Y. Yep, that's okay. It.
Yeah, this woman is walking by in the background. She turns around and it's like, oh, shit. this is the girl who looks like me. This is the girl in the bookstore who looks like me. And she doesn't actually look all that much like her. There are two things which really get Beth annoyed immediately. And the first one is that she's smaller than her. And the second one is that she's younger than her.
Yeah. But she does kind of demand, like, take your hair down because she wants to see. And once she has her hair down, it's a little closer.
Yeah, it's a little closer.
Although, yes, shorter and younger.
Yeah. And Madeline is like, yes, I knew your husband. You know, we were not having an affair, you know, seriously. You know, I sold him some books. We talked. He was a nice guy. And she's like, yes, I know. I know he's a nice guy. You know, and she's just kind of banging away at her. And that's the night that she has a dream where she goes across the lake.
Right, yeah.
Up to the other house. And when she
opens, sees people that look vaguely like her in the house.
Yes, and there's a voice in her ear, a man's voice that sounds like her husband's voice, saying, this is a dream. Don't worry. This is a dream. It isn't real. And when she walks in through the what would be the back door, the door that you go out to go down the stairs onto the deck. There's somebody asleep on the couch where normally she would be asleep, and it's Madeline. And Madeline looks up, and we get this thing, which appears to be this shot, which appears to be from her point of view, showing nobody at the door. And then we reverse and it's Beth. Beth is the person on the couch.
Yeah. I mean, it's very creepy.
Yeah. It's creepy as hell. So, you know, this causes Beth to actually go across, and to try and figure out why she's, you know, why she has this impression in her dreams that there's a house there.
She has a weird conversation with her neighbor Mel about it, because she's going on this walk and he runs into her and goes, hi, what's up? And she's like, is there a house? And he says, no. She's like, well, I'm going to look for one. Would you mind if I, and he says, actually, I would mind.
Yeah.
And he sort of has this kind of weird, like,
proprietary,
but it sort of sounds okay. Like, you know, I'm worried about you. You shouldn't be out here alone. And
You're in a bad place, Beth.
Right. And he invites her to lunch.
Yeah.
But so she's like, yeah, okay, but I'm still going to walk. And she walks, and then she finds the titular night house.
Yeah. It's an interesting situation because, what's across the lake appears to be, public land. It's some kind of park. You're not allowed to build on public land. And
you are not.
Yeah. And Mel goes over there a lot hiking because he has a dog. You know, but he almost talks about it like he's the guy who has to look after the park, which I don't.
Right. Think rather than just a neighbor.
Yeah, exactly. But one way or the other, it's very obvious to Beth that he knows that there is, in fact, something over there. And when she finds the night house, it's not a perfectly constructed house. It is sort of half constructed.
Yeah.
It's in the stages of being built. In fact, it looks very much like her house did in those.
In the home movies.
The home movies that she's always watching, where her husband was, Evan, was working on the house. And so it's like this weird kind of denuded, reversed version of her house.
Right, and there's tarps up, and there's no furniture, and the walls aren't painted, and
yeah, exactly.
She finds this statue with a bunch of
yeah, this extraordinarily odd statue of a woman almost on her knees with her back bent backwards.
Basically looks like she's been impaled by like a whole bunch of spikes.
Yeah, spikes. Yeah. And you know, as one of the guys in the ritual says, that's witchcraft, mate. You know, it really
yeah,
is.
Yeah, yeah. It's I mean, things, this movie does a great job of going from like, well, that's not great, and that's worse, yeah. And that is much worse.
Yeah.
But so it's like, okay, my husband was maybe cheating on me. Okay, there's like 20 pictures of other women that look vaguely like me on his computer.
Yeah.
Okay, he built a separate house that looks like our house. And look, there's a statue with a bunch of spikes in it.
Yeah, and that statue kind of looks like me.
Yeah, that too.
You know.
So she's understandably pissed and goes to Mel's house and, you know, bangs on his door and is like, what the fuck is this?
Yeah, and Mel is like, okay, so here's what happened. I found out that your husband was building this house, and I saw him with women.
Interestingly, he says, at first I thought it was you, so I called out your name, mm-hmm. and the woman turned around, and I realized it wasn't you.
Yes, exactly. It was just someone who looked like you. And he says that her husband told him that he had impulses. He had urges, these sort of sick urges, and he didn't want to take them home. And
Mel's not a great neighbor. I mean, I'm just going to say
that. You know,
like, I know there's a bro code or whatever, but like,
yeah, yeah. There's a bro code.
There's like your neighbor seems like they might be.
Yeah.
Not even having an affair, like they might be killing people. Like, maybe tell someone.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I don't think that Mel immediately assumes that he was
killing. Right, I think at first he just assumed it was a sex thing.
Yeah, yeah, some weird sex thing, you know, where I pick up women who look sort of like my wife and I take them to this fucked up reversed house that I built in the middle of nowhere. And we have sex in the reversed house, you know. But, you know, yeah, I would think that it would become obvious after a while that you never saw those women again.
I mean, yes.
So,
but I don't know how, I mean, it's established that Mel is also a widower.
Exactly.
So he's recently lost his wife.
Mm-hmm.
So it gets into how he's probably not all with it. As well,
himself, yeah,
yeah.
He's in a weird place. He knows about that weird place. Anyway, so she confronts Madeline again, the girl from the store,
the bookstore, yeah,
from the bookstore. And Madeline's like, okay, so yeah, I went to that house once with your husband, and we did kiss, but then he put his hands around my neck, and it was sort of like he was gonna start strangling me, but I looked at him and he stopped. And Beth realizes that, going by what Madeline tells her, that this must have been like a couple of days before he killed himself.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. She returns to the house, and you know, she gets super drunk and returns to the house and starts yelling at her dead husband. And,
right, you know, yelling at nothing. And, yeah, yelling at this nothing. This is such a great reveal. She's like, she sort of steps on a loose floorboard or like breaks. I don't remember the exact.
Yeah, and goes down into a sub-basement kind of area.
Yeah, and so she looks in there and there's a body like wrapped in a
tarp.
Sheet.
Yeah.
A tarp, yeah.
Yeah, and
then she...
Next to another one.
Right, and then you look and it's like, there's just like 15 or something in there.
Yeah. All the women who were in those photos, except for Madeline.
And I kind of knew, like, I mean, I've done a lot of research into serial killers. So when they got into the, like, these people look vaguely like me, I was like, uh-oh.
Yeah. Well, it's sort of like the whole John Wayne Gacy thing of, essentially, it was like he was killing himself over and over. not just sneaky dudes that he was attracted to, but also, you know, guys from the same age that he was when he realized that he was gay.
Yeah, and with Golden State, they were saying, some of the surviving victims said that he would be saying something, and they finally figured out it was his ex-wife's name, and he was, like, swearing, like, fucking Beth or whatever her name was.
Yes, yeah, it was, actually, they weren't, they never got married, but they were engaged.
Oh, okay. So his fiance.
Yeah, and she was like, you know what? There's something about you, man.
And yeah, she got lucky. Yeah.
She did.
Because there sure was. But yeah, so this is. So logically, I think, I don't know. I guess she's drunk, so she just went right back to her regular house.
Yeah,
I mean, I might call the police, but
well, it's a huge reveal, and.
But yeah, I guess the other thing is like. You're still reeling about your dead husband. Do you really also want to reveal him as a serial killer?
Yes. You know, not only did you not know that he was going to kill himself, you didn't know that he had all this inside of him as well.
Yeah.
Now,
so she goes back to the regular house.
Goes back to the regular house. And it's at this point that things really kick off in terms of the supernatural aspect. And there's this very interesting moment where she, you know, again, the wet footprints.
Yeah.
For her. And every time we see the wet footprints, they've come up further and further and further into the house. And eventually they are not just wet, but muddy. Eventually they are not just wet and muddy, but bloody.
Yeah.
As though somebody's, you know, walked in blood, and she is trying to run away from them. And she gets about a couple of steps up the stairs, and it's like something grabs her, something invisible grabs her, and she turns around, and it's as if she's being forced into the same position as that figurine that she found.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, her back is bowing, and her arms are behind her back, and, you know, it's sort of sexy and sort of awful at the same time.
Right, yes.
Yeah, and like she's being transfixed. And then it relaxes, and instead of being like being caught and held, it's as though she reaches out and she feels an invisible person.
Yeah.
And the invisible person feels like her husband. And she moves, you know, and again, you know, as we've said, she's drunk.
Right.
You know, and her, all her impulses are unlocked, and it's as though she's going, oh, it's you, you know, she's just like feeling the face and, you know, and like kissing this person. And, you know, it's like, hug me, hold me, you know, she says.
Right, a very like ghost type
of
moment.
Yeah, except, you know, ghost is only creepy in concept,
right.
You know. I mean, I remember watching Ghost and going, this is super creepy, but I don't think most people were thinking that.
Well, because I mean, like, the portrayal of Patrick Swayze is just
exactly.
As Patrick Swayze.
See Patrick Swayze right there. Here.
Right. So
it's
just
like, looks,
you know, it's just
like.
Intellectually, you know, he's dead. But
yeah, exactly.
But this, very quickly, you realize, I think she says her husband's name.
Yes. Is it you? And, is it you?
And says no. And says, like, uh-oh.
And you're like, yeah. And there's this, and that sort of causes a narrative jerk. Now,
right.
I don't remember what it is that brings her friend towards her house. I think that, she's actually on the phone with her.
Yeah, she tries to call her and she leaves a message,
like,
I think. Oh,
yeah,
I think that's after
leaving,
she finds the bodies.
Yeah, she's leaving like a Prometheus-type message of like, I was wrong. I was so wrong.
Yeah.
I did something
but so,
really bad.
And when she's in the bathroom, too,
yeah.
she sees this, eventually she sees this woman like through the glass with her husband, and then her husband like slams this woman's head into the mirror.
That's right. And then something invisible slams her head into the mirror.
Right. And she sort of, I'm still not entirely sure, but basically we get into the series of like, I don't know if they're hallucinations or if they're her just somehow transported to these times, but
yeah,
she's able to see all of the stuff her husband did.
Exactly.
Or some of it.
Yeah. And there's a lot of mirroring going on, literal mirroring going on, where you're like, is this the husband or is this a shadow of the husband? The same way that the night house is a shadow of the real house, you know?
Yeah. And like, there's a very chilling scene where she's laying in her husband's lap and you can tell he's sort of like,
yeah,
thinking about like, should I kill her?
Yes. Yeah. He has his hand on her throat and she's just like, oh, that's so nice. That's so romantic. I mean, it's really interesting because as a deconstruction of the idea of romanticism.
Right. Yeah.
You know, it's like we're so bound at what is it, that line from Wuthering Heights? Whatever souls are made of, his and mine are made of the same stuff.
Yeah.
And
I think that's it.
Yeah. You know, this idea of that a perfect relationship is where to some degree you are the same person.
Right. And this sort of turns that on its head to show you are 100% not the same person.
Yeah. You're 100% not the same person and you would not want to be the same person.
No.
But at the most, if you were the same sort of person, you would be like an echo of the other person or like a reflection of the other person.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, you would be, you know, he would be the night house and you would be the day house. You know.
Right. And so at some point, though, she starts basically talking to this personification of nothing.
Yeah. Yeah. She starts talking to the personification of her dead husband. He's naked. They're sitting in the boat in the middle of the lake under this bloody red double moon.
Yeah.
This bloody sky. And he says, you know, do you remember when you went into the dark? I was there and I saw you. And I wanted you. And I knew that you were for me.
Yeah.
And later when he married you, I began to talk to him. I began to whisper in his ear that he had to give you back. But he didn't give you back. He gave back all these other women. And, you know, the idea is that this is this weird kind of witchcraft, this ritual that he worked out for himself, where it's like, you know, if I kill women who look enough like my wife, if in the house that I built that's the opposite of my house.
Then somehow this thing gets tricked.
Somehow this thing gets tricked. But
well, it took me until a second watch, but apparently in the book, that statue is like a binding sort of a statue.
Yeah, that's right. And so the fact that she takes it from that house.
Right. That's when when the nothing starts appearing to her is when she takes the statue.
Yes. Yeah. And she transfers it back to the day house.
Yeah.
And that's when it gets a hold of her directly. But yeah, you know, so in the note that he left for her, the nothing that is after her is this thing, which is a reflection of her husband, which organizes itself as a reflection of her husband. But, you know, from its point of view, it's her real husband. And the husband was a reflection of it.
Right. And it is sort of clever the way the note suddenly takes on this other meaning of like, there is nothing.
Yeah.
Nothing. Not there is nothing. It's like there is a nothing thing.
Yes.
And you're safe now because I killed myself.
Yeah. But but she isn't safe.
No, and there's this very stressful thing where she's on the boat and it kind of cuts between this like alternate reality and then the real reality.
Yeah.
And so her friend Claire is seeing her in the boat, like putting a gun up to her chest.
Yeah, and it's not even night.
No, it's during the day.
During the day, you know. Mel's there, Claire's there, you know, she's putting a gun up to her head, she's gonna kill herself, you know. And
I don't honestly remember why she decides not to. I think she eventually sort of hears Claire's voice.
Yes, she does. She hears Claire's voice. And, you know, I mean, if you're dealing with a thing that really wants you to die, where that would be the best thing, the best gift you could give it, then the best revenge would be to keep living.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, which is, I mean, again, it's like, it's about grief. Yeah. You could see it as a metaphor. You could see it as a metaphor of how, about how suicide sometimes breeds suicide. You know, if he killed himself, why shouldn't I kill myself? You know, why shouldn't we be together? You know, would we be together if this happened? You know, but yeah, that the best revenge against the nothing is to keep living.
And I think eventually Claire ends up basically in the boat or like outside the boat.
Pulling her out of the boat and the water wakes her completely up. And she's like swimming her back towards the dock. And Mel is helping her to pull Beth out of the water. And they look back at the boat and there is something again sitting in the boat. It's a darkness.
Right. It's just sort of like shadows formed into this shape.
Yes. And Claire says, "What's that?" And she says, "Nothing. That's nothing."
And that's the end of the film. I mean, I really like this movie.
I really liked it as well. I mean, I must admit that much like the end of Malignant, where you're like, oh, such a happy ending. You know, everything's so wonderful, except you just killed 30 cops.
Right, and this version is like, everything worked out well, okay, her husband is a serial killer, and they never really, I mean, there's every indication that the nothing is still going to go after her.
Oh, no, the nothing is absolutely going to...
Like, it's not gone, she doesn't banish it, she just doesn't kill herself.
That's right, yeah. But again, it's, if you see the nothing as, like, the literal... the literal embodiment of the big black hole. You can't get away from existential dread.
Right. I think that's the point, is there is no getting away from the nothing. It's just you can delay meeting with it.
Yes. You can be aware of it. You can see how you go closer to it. And you can feel its gravitational pull. Its gravitational pull, and then fight against that gravitational pull.
Yeah. I mean, I think cinematically, I definitely love this movie. I love the sound design. My only issue is perhaps narratively, and I know the intent is not this, but it does come across sometimes as depressive people will make you crazy. I mean, there's no way to not see that interpretation.
Well, you know, I think living with depression, living with suicidal ideation.
Yeah.
You know, you can feel as though you're drifting in and out of like psychosis, I suppose.
Yeah, no, that's
true. You know, like overt psychosis. You know, it's like, oh yeah, you know, how was your weekend? Well, I had these moments where I wanted to die, but I didn't.
Yeah, and I do think my interpretation is that the nothing is a real, that it's not a metaphor, because that's easier for me to sit with, because then it's like, well, he didn't have a choice. Like,
yeah, exactly.
He didn't want to kill his wife. I mean, yeah, well, he had a choice. But
it is meant to be something, some real thing. Some disembodied thing. Is it a demon? Is it a ghost? Is it, you know, it's like somebody who wouldn't move through the tunnel.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. We don't know. We may never
know. I think
know.
This film is stronger for not explaining it, honestly.
I believe that as well, yeah. I believe that as well. And, you know, I'll tell you, I wasn't completely satisfied with it when I watched it, but I've been thinking really hard about it ever since. And I would rather have that in a movie than almost anything else.
Yeah, what's interesting about this movie is the first time I watched it, I think with the ending, I was sort of like, I mean, I didn't mean to, but I made a joke at the beginning of the movie, like, I bet grief is the monster.
Well,
and then it was like, holy shit. Okay, yes.
Shit, grief was the monster.
Yeah, but, you know, so the first time I was like, I liked it, but I had my caveats. But I went back and rewatched it, and it really does hold up with a rewatch.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I need to rewatch it, and I think I will find the same thing. So, yeah, one way or the other, thank you so much for wanting to talk about it. And
yeah, I mean, I think this is one of the better horror films. I guess technically it came out in 2020, but
yeah, but
one of the better recent horror films, yeah.
Absolutely. And yeah, possibly one of the best films of this year, I think.
Yeah, and I'm excited that Bruckner is doing a remake of Hellraiser, because especially after seeing Nighthouse, when I saw that little statue with the pins in it, I was like, oh.
Yeah, that's pretty super, super Barkarian.
It's pretty on the nose, yeah.
I like it. I like it. It's good.
Yeah, so super excited for that. But I think that's going to wrap it up.
Okay.
Going to do the quick plug. We're on Twitter at CelluloidSits, anchor.fm/CelluloidSits. I'm on Twitter also as at SpookySeanT, Gemma, sorry. I think your Twitter is just...
At GemmaFiles.
Yeah. So we're both on Twitter. And yeah, if you like the show, you know, rate it, tell your friends, subscribe.
Yeah.
I really appreciate it. So yeah, thanks for coming on, Gemma.
All right. Always fun. And I'll come back anytime.
All right. And yeah, don't make a mirror of your house, and obviously don't kill people that look like your spouse.
And definitely don't take the Clive Barker-esque statue.
Yeah, don't take the weird statue with the nails in it.
Yeah, exactly. You know, just leave it there. Just leave it. Leave it.